This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam Kasten-Smith, and joining me today is Will.
Hi, Sam.
And today we're moving along in our series on the miracles of Jesus, and we're going to be talking about two of them put together that come kind of at the bookends of the gospel. The first one is going to be the calling of the Apostle Peter. The other one is going to be the restoration of the Apostle Peter, because they're very similar in how they speak to each other, how they relate to one another, and it actually brings out some of the more beautiful elements of the restoration to put these two miracles together.
Yeah, Peter's a fun character. I mean, he's the guy who's always, right or wrong, he's the one who always speaks up. He's kind of the bold one. He's the one who's like, hey, Jesus, I'll never deny. After Jesus, like, you're going to deny me. He's the guy who's like, oh, I'll never do that. And then he denies him. It's just, I like Peter, and I like the narrative of him. Like, it's an unvarnished look at Peter, and I love that about him.
Yeah, he is totally confident when he shouldn't be. he has a lot of belief in who he is. Like, so, I mean, everybody can relate to him where it's like, oh, man, I messed up. And
he gets things right, though, sometimes.
He totally does. He's bold. He's wonderful.
Yeah, so he's awesome.
And the Lord really, really loves this guy, even though he suffers like foot and mouth disease all the time. So we pick up with him, and these are guys that are up in Galilee. And that's an interesting thing that I want to explore before we jump into this narrative. Like, because Judea, if you're looking at Israel in the first century, in the southern part where Jerusalem is, that's Judea. Then you come a little bit north, and you have Samaria, and that was like, we don't go there. That's where the half-breeds are.
Did they walk around Samaria? That's how badly they didn't want to cut through Samaria.
Correct. So Samaria was seen as like the Assyrians conquered there and interbred with the locals. And so they're seen as like they're not pure. They're not really Jews. They fell into idolatry. They have different beliefs and weird things going on.
They worship on Mount Gerizim, right?
That's right, Mount Gerizim.
This rock is from Mount Gerizim.
Yeah, they believe that's where Isaac was supposedly going to be offered up at, rather than Jerusalem. They have weird different beliefs. And so then north of Samaria, you get to Galilee, and those are seen as like, okay, now we're back into real Jewish territory. It's a terrible way to say that, but that was the prevailing attitude at the time. But even still, if you were up in Galilee, you're not like first string Jewish class of the first century. You're like, you know, you're Galilee, which it's nice, but you're not Jerusalem. And so when the Lord starts calling all of his disciples, it's just fascinating to me that Galilee is his recruiting turf. You know, if he's looking for, you know, people to draft up into the majors, he doesn't go to the big universities down south. He's pulling from like 2A, 3A, or D3 schools, and this is where he's pulling his disciples from. So, and Galilee, the other part of it is it's not only that they were seen as like second-class-ish Jews, but Galilee was seen as some of the first places that went apostate. So if you go back to the Old Testament, you know, you have David and Solomon and the 12 tribes of Israel. The kingdom splits and the 10 tribes of the north immediately fall into idolatry. But Galilee is considered among those that are like the first to fall. They're the first to walk away from God. And so, for example, when they fall into idolatry, they're invited after the Assyrians come and conquer them. Hezekiah actually sent couriers to the north saying, hey, come back. Like, I know that you guys have been overrun, but you're welcome to come back into the family of God, return to the Lord. And these people scorned and ridiculed Hezekiah's couriers. Like, they just wanted nothing to do with the Lord. They walked away. They were the first to kind of run into darkness. And so when you get in Isaiah, it'll refer to Galilee of the Gentiles, which that was seen as like a derogatory kind of title, because it's like you're no longer Jews, you're overrun with Gentile culture, and yet that comes in Isaiah 9:1 when it starts talking about the Messiah, that it's Galilee of the Gentiles. That's where this darkness is going to see a bright light that comes into the world, and I think that's cool that the first people that ran away from God the ones that went into the deepest darkness, that's where Jesus comes and says, these are going to be my inner core of apostles. I'm going to call from Galilee.
And this group specifically, would it be fair to say it's Galilee's more of a blue-collar work, so to say, than, like, the religious elites aren't there.
Correct.
The politicians aren't there.
Correct.
It's more of like, I mean, we're going to see these guys are just fishermen.
Yeah.
And in a lot of people's eyes, it's just like they're uneducated. I mean, they talk about it themselves in the book of Acts and stuff, like these uneducated guys are turning the world upside down, and here they are.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good way to look at it. Like, there's the old line, you know, Jesus doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called. And you see that, like, these are guys that are ordinary Joes, normal fishermen. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to choose you. And when Paul writes about it, he says, Jesus chose them on purpose so that no one could say, oh, he recruited some A team, you know, the best philosophers in the royal court. Like, he chose the weak in the eyes of the world to shame and show up the strong, and to show that this movement had to be of God, because he didn't take any special advantage in recruiting, you know, these awesome, amazing people. It just shows that this is entirely owed to the Spirit of God.
And that would have been shocking to, I mean, when the crowds are gathering on Jesus, you see these are the guys that he comes out with. Like,
that's right.
This is the public ministry of Jesus. These are 12 guys I chose. Here they are.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to stay true. Like, when you go through the Gospels with that, and this is one of the uncomfortable facts of the Gospel, is the elite and the put together, it's very rare that they come to Jesus. Mm. Like, I mean, you find guys like Nicodemus, but that's the exception. Most of them that are put together or that have any wealth or that have any prestige, they look down at Jesus. But who is it that flocks to Jesus?
All the outcasts, everyone who has tons of things wrong with them.
That's right. So they make fun of him for, you know, hanging out with the drunkards and prostitutes and all these kinds of people. And he calls tax collectors to himself. It's like those are the people that are hated, the fringes, the outcasts, the morally reprobate. Like, those are the people that are transformed by him and that draw near to him. And Isaiah, let me just read this passage from Isaiah chapter 9. It says, nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now, those are the two tribes that were right at Galilee. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles. Mm. By way of the sea along the Jordan, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. In Isaiah 9, this is the section where it says, you know, for unto us a child is born, a son is given. So it's anticipating Jesus, and it's saying it's going to start in Galilee. And sure enough, as we get to today's passage, that's exactly what we find. So let's jump into Luke chapter 5, where the calling of Peter is, and Andrew, and James, and John, for that matter. But it says, on one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, so he's already started preaching, he's got lots of people coming to him, miracles are already happening in mass.
And the crowds always seem so, like, this is happens a lot to Jesus, like, he has to bail because the crowds are, like, so pressing in on him. Yeah, they seem rude all the time to Jesus.
This is correct.
Like, all the time, Jesus is like, I had to get on a boat and get out of there, I had to, you know, flee. It's wild to me how people are just rude.
But they're desperate. Yeah. You know, I remember one of the stories when we went to Haiti like a year or two after the earthquake. So we're talking total economic desperation, poverty, and like real desperation to feed families. And they give you a warning when you were coming out of the airport back then. Now Haiti's again in crisis. But when you came out of the airport, they're like, a lot of people are going to swarm you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are going to be all over you. And they're going to be pressing in. And they're going to be grabbing at your luggage. Don't freak out. You know, but also don't give them money or anything like that, because if you do, you'll get mobbed because of the desperation and the needs of these people. And sure enough, like, we came out of the airport.
It's a wild experience. Yeah.
I had 10, 11 guys all around me leaning in and touching my luggage. They weren't trying to grab it or steal it, but it was just like they wanted to say, hey, we helped you with your luggage. You owe us a tip. And it was just desperation for that. And I, you know, like, I remember thinking, okay, this is real need. You can't fault them. They're trying to feed their children and take care of their families.
Yeah, there's no other way.
But at the same time, that desperation caused them to see, oh, you're from the West. You're an American. You probably have money. And then, I mean, you're just overwhelmed and crowded. And here's Jesus, who's this God walking around as a man who's got miraculous powers. And it's like everybody starts hearing that. Everybody's in a desperate condition. And so you imagine, you know, it's not just 10 or 11 guys.
Yeah.
It's thousands in some instances where the crowds are just pressing in on him. And if you're claustrophobic, yikes, this would be hard, because it's the crowd was pressing in on him. And he doesn't say, get away from me. He's like, stop touching me. They're pressing in on him to hear the word of God. He was standing by the Lake of Gennesaret, which is...
Sea of Galilee?
Yeah, it's the Sea of Galilee. Sometimes it's called the Sea of Tiberias, but this is Galilee. And he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Now, what does that mean?
They're done for the day.
They're done for the day. What were? Do you remember Tom preaching on this? First time I had ever heard that. Do you know what the nets were made of? Do you remember? Because we think...
Of course. I remember everything Tom's ever said. I'm just
kidding. We think of, like, a fishing net is made of, like, nylon. Yeah, you know,
like fishing line.
Fishing line. Totally. Back then, you know, they don't have that technology to produce that. So entire fishing net is made of linens. Oh. Like, it's actual stuff that you would make clothes with. And so they make these nets. They're constantly tearing. They're not as strong. You know, the fibers are not as strong. And so every time they pull in their nets that have been dragging on the bottom, they've got mud in them and all kinds of stuff. They're torn. So when you would retire your nets for the day, guess what you have to do?
Fix them.
You got to fix them. You got to tie them together. You got to mend them. You got to look at them. And then because it's, you know, fabric, these things are outrageously heavy because they absorb so much water, but they have to dry because they're crazy heavy. So they're done for the day. They fish all night. They bring in their nets. They have to mend all the things. This thing's got to dry. And so the fishermen are done. They're washing their nets. They're ready for them to be done. They're going to go to bed and sleep because they fish all night and sleep during the day. And then it says, getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's. This is Peter's name before Jesus changes it.
A little forward also, Jesus just hopped in the boat.
Yeah. He asked him to put out a little from the land. And so Peter's like, all right, you know, I put in a hard night's work. I'm already frustrated because I didn't catch anything all night. But if this is, you know, what you're telling me to do, I guess I'll do it. And here's something, if you're reading through this story, you know, the different gospels pull out the narrative a little bit different and give details. Andrew is Peter's brother.
Okay.
And Andrew had been introduced to Jesus because Andrew was a disciple of John the Baptist. And Andrew knows this is the guy. Like, there's a lot of buzz about him being the Messiah. So he's already come to Peter and been like, you know, this guy is the one. So Peter's not like, oh, here's a stranger who's just getting into my boat.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I'm sure Peter's like, there's a lot of different people who run around claiming to be Messiah, and they skeptical build up false cults or whatever. So it's like, okay, he gets into a boat that's Simon's. He asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and he taught the people from the boat. And when he finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Now, if you're Peter, it's not just like, you know, cast your net again and pull it back in, and that's not a big ask.
Fish line worth thinking about, like, very little effort.
This is a big deal. Like, if you're doing it, you're resetting a long process. You're asking me to do a lot of things, to remend, to start the drying process over again, to clean everything. So this is a big ask. And Simon answered. I think he's trying to be like, are you for real asking me to do this? Master, he says, which shows you what's his posture.
It's respectful.
It's respectful. It's not Lord. It's not Almighty God, but it's, you know, I recognize you're a man of authority. You're a rabbi. You know, you deserve respect. Master, we toiled all night and we took nothing. But at your word, you know, if you're serious about this, I will let down my nets.
It's frustrating. One vacation, my family went to Lake Lanier, which is outside of Atlanta, and my dad was all jazzed. You know, he rented a boat for the week. And we got up every single morning at the crack of dawn to go fishing. We didn't catch a single fish that whole week. So I feel Peter's desperation here to be like, do we have to go back out there?
Yeah, what's even worse, you never want me on a boat. Like, if I'm on your boat breaks down.
Oh,
like,
okay, that's good to
know. I'm such a bad luck charm on a boat. Like, I mean, every time something goes wrong, the trailer axle breaks, the boat motor won't start.
You guys
start,
never even get into the water.
So, yeah, it's not even a matter of catching fish. It's like survival time if I'm on your boat. And then my brother Matt, who's totally charmed, he could fish in a rain puddle and catch fish. Like, that guy just brings them in. I could sit there for hours, and it's like I'm catching stingrays and catfish and all the things you don't want that you're, like, dangerous to catch. Anyway. So Peter does it, and it says when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and the nets were breaking. And they signaled to their partners in the other boat, this is James and John, to come and help them. And so, like, what do you pull out of that? Like, why is this miraculous?
I mean, if they fished all night and didn't get one, but all of a sudden the Sea of Galilee looks like a trout farm.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Then there's something miraculous here.
Yeah, so much so that the nets are breaking. They need another boat to haul in this massive catch. But what, like, when you think about this, it's the timing of it. But this means that this one who's in the boat who says, okay, now try it. Now try dropping your nets. The crazy part of this miracle is that he's in control of creatures.
Oof.
That means that somehow this God in human flesh, before he says drop your nets, somehow puts it in the minds of hundreds of fish, come over here and stop and park under this side of the boat because Peter and Andrew are about to drop their nets. That's pretty wild.
Like, yeah, what a life lesson for us. How many times have we tried something that we want, that we desire, that's good, and we're just doing it in our own strength, and it's not until Jesus says, all right, now do it.
Yeah, just totally true. And the part of this, like, he's got control over all of nature. He puts the fish exactly where they're supposed to be, and then he says, okay, now try. And it's when he's in it that this becomes a fruitful endeavor, when they've been wasting all night. And that's, you know, that's one of the things, I go back to this quote all the time, that's one of my favorites from John Quincy Adams, just because I think it's brilliant. But it's duty is ours, results belong to God.
Huh.
You know, like, okay, you've got a duty to do your things as a Christian, to share the gospel, to pray for people. But at the end of the day, like, it's dropping a net down into the unknown. You don't know what's there. You don't know if your evangelism is going to bear fruit. You don't know if your prayers are going to be answered. But God calls you, drop your net, throw your net, like, see what's down there. And ultimately, he's responsible. He's just as responsible for the fact that they didn't catch a thing all night. He kept the fish from going underneath their boat. You ever think of that? Like, he's absolutely just as sovereign for the no catch as he is for the abundant catch. And he had a purpose for both of them. What's the purpose for no catch?
So when they do catch, it's something more special?
That's right. I mean, so this is going to be like, wow, you're set apart. But it's also a desperation that I can't do this on my own. Like, this is how they make their livelihood. This is like, oh, come on. Like, I need this. And it shows, you know what? I can't do this in my own strength. I'm not equipped to make this happen on my own. I need the Lord. And here he is, sovereign over nature. And everybody who's on the shore listening to the sermon sees it. Everybody, you know, the boat next door to them, and, you know, James and John, they see it. And so God uses this moment, uses the surprise of this moment to preach the gospel, to make everybody around there go, whoa, something is different about this guy. Something's different about this guy. I think he may actually be the Messiah. And so the other boat comes over to help them. They came and filled both boats so that the boats started to seem like they were going to sink. But Peter, in the midst of all this, realizes, like, okay, there's something bigger going on than just the excitement of this huge payday that I just scored. And he realizes, this is not possible. I've been fishing from a wee little boy. Like, this has never happened. I've never seen this happen. I've never even heard of this happening, to where in one cast, boats are filling up and sinking. Like, this guy is different. He is the Messiah. This is God. Who else controls nature like this? And so he has an interesting reaction that I think is worth talking about. It says, but when Peter saw it, he stops and realizes it. He fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. Do you think that's the right reaction?
I do.
I mean, it's an understandable reaction. I mean,
it's like Isaiah 6.
Yeah.
It's like when you really see the Lord. I mean, he's experiencing the Lord, and he's seeing him like an unvarnished, like he has a picture of Jesus in front of him. And that's when you compare yourself to that, you're like, I got to go. Get me out of here.
Yeah, I mean, it is Isaiah, like, woe is me. You know, I come from a people of unclean lips, and I have unclean lips. I'm not worthy to be in the presence of God. And it's like, get away from me, depart from me, depart from me. And that is the right answer, unless God is seeking sinners. And I think that part of it is the surprise to Peter, because his response is, I am totally inadequate. I am totally unworthy to be in your presence. I do not measure up to be in your presence. I don't measure up to be on your team. The right response is, I'm unworthy. You should go away from me before I contaminate you or your cause. And yet this is exactly who Jesus is looking for. When he says, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, it's like Jesus is going,
yeah,
duh.
Look around.
Right? You're exactly who I've come for.
It's awesome.
It's your inadequacy is why I'm here. It is why I came for you. And, you know, Jesus doesn't say, you're right. Oh, let me look for someone better. Yeah, you are pretty deficient. Like, that's the whole point. Like, I'm recruiting you to my team because of your inadequacies. I am going to account. I'm going to make good and to restore the places where you're broken.
And I love that. I mean, Peter's an in-the-moment guy. And I love that about him, because I don't think I am. Like, I think I struggle with that. But like right here, he's not looking back at this event days later and finally clicking. But in the midst, he's okay with being honest and vulnerable about where he's at in the moment. And I think that's an astounding quality in him.
And he will learn. He's going to spend the next 3 years chasing Jesus, realizing, you know, the initial reaction is, I'm a sinner, get away from me, right?
Yeah.
The right reaction for a Christian is what? I'm a sinner.
Please,
I need to get as close to you as I possibly can. Like, and so you'll see Peter's heart change between these two miracles that we're going to talk about today in ways that it's so instructive for us. You know, like when I first was toying around with the idea of coming to faith, do you know what kept me away from God? It wasn't, you know, I don't find him beautiful enough. You know, I need to realize that he's worth it. That was not what kept me from God. What kept me from God was, I'm going to feel like a fake. This is imposter syndrome. I am not worthy to be on his team. If anybody knew the mess of a human being that I am and all of my sinful ways and addictions and everything else that I'm coming to the table with, like, I would be a total charlatan if I claimed to be chasing after Jesus. So because I'm a sinful man, no, Jesus.
Yeah.
You stay over there a little longer. When I get my act clean up, maybe I'll come around. And it's like, no, you dolt. Like, that's exactly the reason why you should come to him. Yeah. Because you're a sinful man. Because you're inadequate. You don't get adequate and then chase after Jesus. You come to him with all your brokenness and all your shame and all your guilt and all your sin, and he's the one that redeems all that. He begins to change your heart. He is the one who atones for all your sin, and Peter is gonna learn that over the course of his life. And so for now, depart from me, for I am a sinful man. And notice what he says, oh Lord. It's changed from master to now Lord. For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken, and so also were James and John. So these are going to be the first four apostles that come to him. So Peter, Andrew, James, and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. Just all the time, you know, like when God or the angelic realm has anything to say to man, it almost always starts with, do not be afraid.
Isn't that the most commanded phrase in all the Bible?
It is the most commanded phrase.
I don't know if that's a good way to put it. It felt weird, but
the most repeated command. How about there? So, but don't be afraid. Like, cause Peter's initial response is, get away from me. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I'm totally inadequate. And he's like, just stop.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid. From now on, you'll be catching men. And so again, when we go back to the illustration of evangelism, your responsibility is to cast your nets, right? Who's responsible for putting the fish either in or out of the net?
The Lord.
The Lord. That's, I mean, the same deal. you're going to be casting your nets. You have no idea what your net is falling onto. You have zero idea. That's the Lord's business. So he says, from now on, you'll be catching men, and I will be the one responsible for either bringing the harvest or not. So when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him.
Which is wild. Because we know Peter has a mother-in-law, which means he has a wife.
Right.
So some of them, I sometimes imagine disciples just as like young bachelors that, okay, they're walking away from their jobs, but they get this fun time following Jesus around. But for some of them, especially Peter, I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, you're cashing in. You got to think about this. Like if I said, hey, I found, I mean, just imagine, if I came in here and I said I found a new Messiah, like it would be heretical or something.
This is going off the rails.
Right. Yeah, I've gone off the rails a little bit. But imagine living in the first century and you're like, I'm following a man that I believe is God. And everybody goes, whoa, you're way off the rails. Like this is heretical. So you're losing your respect. You're losing your friends. Your family is probably thinking weird things of you. You set aside your livelihood. You're setting aside everything, all of your identity, all your security to walk away and follow this guy. You know,
I'm just thinking about trying to explain to Morgan why I'm about to travel for 3 years.
Yeah.
Follow this guy around just based off of this story.
Yeah.
And her being like, no chance.
Okay. Uh-huh. Like, we need to Baker-act you now.
Yeah, like.
And that's a very real thing. So when you see this, the fact that they responded with such incredible obedience. And, I mean, they had been hearing miraculous stories. They'd been, you know, there's buzz around Jesus. So the fact that he comes to you and you're the very first person that says, you know, everybody else he's healing. But you now are the very first person that he comes to. Imagine the weight of this. And he says, Will. Follow me. I'm going to make you a fisher of men. And it's like, all right, like he's recruiting all of these rabbis and everybody else. They have their own disciples. Now the Messiah himself is coming and saying, you are going to be number one recruit on my team. Like, whoa.
And I've never thought of this part. Jesus provides for them and they're giving up everything. I mean, this haul could have been, I don't know how much they're catching every single day, but it seems like this miraculous amount would provide for their families for quite a while.
Yeah.
Which I thought is interesting. Like, Jesus graciously is like, hey, I'm calling you, and I'm taking out some of the obstacles right here, right now.
That's a really good point. I've never thought of that, but I think that's absolutely right. He, like, gives them this, you know, rainmaker, you know, big, huge payday to be like, okay, I'm going, but we just made a lot of money. Yeah, so
we're going to be good for a while.
This covers it. Yeah. And might cover some of his expenses as he's going around for the next months or so.
It's interesting. Yeah,
that really is. That's a good point. So they leave everything and they follow him. And, you know, that's the name for the church in the Greek, ekklesia, means called out ones, which is fascinating, because whenever you look at the people of God, they're always being called out of, you know, Abraham has to leave the land of Haran. God calls him and he leaves everything to follow him. When you find the great stories, Ruth, you know, I'm going to leave and your people are going to be my people, your God, my God, I'm leaving everything behind that I'm familiar with. Peter, the same, the apostles are going to be the same. Like when God calls you, he calls you to be comfortable enough to where you're willing to set aside. You don't necessarily have to do it, but you have to be willing to say, you know what, you're Lord of my life, and I'm willing to lay down everything, my wealth, my security, my home, my comforts, to follow you because you're more important than everything else in my life. And that's a lot easier said than done. And Peter is willing to do that, which is pretty phenomenal.
And I think that's a shift he makes. If you're dutiful to just a master, there's only so far you will go for that master.
That's right.
But then all of a sudden, if you shift into, oh, you're Lord, you're over everything now, then it's not easy to give up, but it's purposeful.
That's right. And so, like, he's going to go through his life with all kinds of confusions following God. Like, Jesus doesn't always do what he anticipates him doing. He's going to have lots of questions. Jesus is like, you know, I'm going to have to go to a cross and I'm going to die. And Peter's like, that's not the vision of the Messiah.
Let's not do that, Jesus.
Like, I left everything for you. And now you're telling me you're not even going to establish a kingdom here. Like, what is going on? And, you know, when Jesus coming toward the end, you know, fast forward 3 years, and Jesus is giving him that message, like, I'm going to die. and I'm going to be raised, and I'm going to leave you guys. And Peter's like, first off, I'll never let you die. And Jesus, you know, get behind me, Satan. Stop with this. But Peter's like, you know, then Jesus is like, you're going to be the one who denies me. And what's Peter say?
I never deny you, Jesus.
I would never do that. You know, I'll die before I ever deny you. And Jesus is like, before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times. And so that's exactly what happens. And Luke, I think, is my favorite version that tells us that. And we're leading toward this next miracle where Peter's restored. But Luke tells the story where Peter is in the courtyards. He's watching the guy that he's set aside everything for. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, hey, honey, you know, I'm going to go chase this guy for a few years, anticipating that this is going to have a happy ending and he's going to be on a royal court and he's going to be in the inner circle of the messianic king that comes to power. And this is going to be a great decision for our family financially. You know, think about that. And then Jesus starts saying, no, I'm going to die. I'm going to be, you know, risen and I'm going to leave. And then you're going to be here on your own. And it's like, wait a minute. I told my wife that, you know, we have the easy street coming. All of these are shaken expectations. But in Luke's gospel, Peter denies him three times when Jesus is in the worst of his suffering. You know, being beaten and spat upon in the trial before the Sanhedrin. And one of the things that's the most one of the most haunting verses in all of Scripture is when he denies Jesus for the third time. It says, like, he begins to call down curses. Like, he is so intense, so irate. I do not know the man. And as those words come out of his mouth, you know, the rooster crows and he turns and he looks at Jesus and it says that they lock eyes. And I want you to imagine being in the middle of betraying your closest friend, your Messiah, your God, as he's in the middle of his suffering. And it says, when that rooster crowed, the two, Jesus looked at him and they lock eyes. And it says, Peter runs off and he weeps bitterly. Can you relate to that?
Yeah. I mean, that's tough. But also from Peter's perspective, obviously he didn't have that in the morning just because of what that would have done to him. But like the fact that the Bible says Jesus looked at Peter, like it was an intentional look. I think part of that in the moment, I think I'd feel guilt. But I think after I would see the compassion almost of Jesus in this. Like Jesus didn't abandon Peter, even though Peter was trying to run from Jesus as fast as he could. And just the graciousness of God to see Peter at his worst. And then go to a cross for what Peter just did.
And one of the wild things is before Peter does this third denial, before he betrays Jesus, essentially, when Jesus is like, you're going to betray me, like that, it's just, that's going to happen. He also tells Peter that after you've done it, to go back to Galilee. In other words, like, I'm not done with you. You're going to do it. It doesn't disqualify you from my love. Like, you're going to be restored. He gives him that assurance that he's going to pursue him even after he's failed him. And so in that moment, Peter's dealing with the heartbreak that I am not as faithful as I thought. I just watched this man that I love to pieces with. I've left everything for, and I've just betrayed him in the moment where he needed me most. I don't understand this. I tried to fight for him, but he wouldn't let me, but I didn't want to suffer along with him. And so I'm just a coward. I'm not the man I thought I was. I mean, he is rocked. You know, could God ever love me? And so then we get to John chapter 1, and you enter into the weight of what Peter had to have been feeling, with that being the last moment with the Lord before his death and resurrection. We're not told about the conversations that he has in the immediate aftermath of the resurrection. So in John 21, you get the first interaction between the two since that. And we're told that, you know, the disciples go back north. They go to Galilee after this, which is what Jesus had told them to do. And it listen to the story. It says, just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet his disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? And they answered him, No. So what's the circumstance going on here? They've been fishing all night, and they haven't caught anything. Does that sound familiar?
Yep.
So he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you'll find some. And so they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. Does that sound familiar?
Yep, tracking.
Right? Like, the disciple whom Jesus loved, now that's the way that the apostle John refers to himself in his own gospel. It's like, I don't want to have an identity. My only identity is the one Jesus loved. Or you,
yeah,
think
you keep
a different
saying
way.
That. I'm
taking
believe
it the humble
that.
Way.
You take it the humble way. I take it as not.
No,
it's not prideful. It's just he knew that Jesus loved it. I mean, I wish I could say that so confidently about myself all the time.
Yeah.
Like, if I could walk around day in and day out being like, I am a disciple that Jesus loved.
Yeah.
Like, my life would be different. So, like, I'm all for John saying it. Like, John's awesome in the fact that, man, he's so, his whole identity is based off the fact that Jesus loves him, and that's it. That's all he cares about.
That's pretty cool. But it says, the disciple whom Jesus loved, he's in the boat with a number of the other apostles. But John says to Peter, it's the Lord. Like, he knows right away. Like, we've seen this before. Remember, like, James and John back in Luke chapter 5. We were in that other boat. We saw this before. Like, this has to be the Lord because only he does this. And what I love Peter's response. Like, it says, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work. So he's got, like, his underwear cloth on. And the reason for that, by the way, is they don't have changes of clothes like we do. It seems weird that a bunch of guys are out there in their underwear fishing. But they don't have like a million changes of clothes in their closet. They've got like one garment, right? And so they don't want fish guts and scales and everything else on there. So Peter is essentially in his underwear, and he doesn't care. Like, he just throws himself into the sea. And the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from land, about 100 yards off. But I love Peter's response, because remember when this miracle first happened? What was Peter's response?
Depart from me.
Depart from me, for I am a sinful man. Hmm. Then he just committed what is, you know, arguably one of the worst sins, one of the most shameful sins that you could do in the Bible, which is denying Jesus in the middle of his greatest need, running away, betraying him after you swore up and down that you never would. Mm. And Peter's reaction is not to shrink in the boat and be like, did he see me? Oh my goodness.
I'd be hiding this, under the right? seats, whatever they had.
Gosh, this would be so tempting to be like, oh, I don't want to see him. This is so awkward. Like, he's going to be so disappointed in me. I'm not sure that he could love me. He's going to be angry. He's going to cast me off the team, whatever. Peter knows the Lord so well that at this moment, what's his reaction? I can't even put on my clothes. I'm not going to wait for us to get the fish in the boat. I'm not going to wait for us to sail to shore. Like, I am diving in the water to get to him as fast as is humanly possible because I've been carrying around this debilitating shame and grief and tears. And the thing that I want most is just to be with him, to hug him, and to know deep in my bones that his heart is to restore me. Like, that's where Peter is.
And Peter knows that Jesus is the only guy who can release him from that.
That's absolutely right. And so, like, when for us, what do we take away from this? Like, the Lord loves us, and we get into these shameful seasons. We do these awful things. What's the right response? The
right response is run towards Jesus.
Run as fast as you can. Get to him any way you can, as fast as you can, because the heart of our God, it doesn't treat sin lightly, but my goodness, he went to a cross so that you could be cleansed of it.
Yep.
He's eager to forgive. And so it says, when they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place. It's like Jesus has prepared something for them. Like, hey, we're going to have a meal. Like,
this is so funny that resurrected Jesus is just like, yeah, prepping the table for these guys.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, and so with fish laid out on it and bread, so it's like he's already like, you know, you got your catch. I've already gone ahead. We've got some fish and bread ready to go. And Jesus said to him, bring some of the fish that you've just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard, hauled the net ashore, full of fish, 153 of them, which...
it's a lot of fish.
That's a lot of fish, but it's one of those details where, like, why would John record that unless they were so impressed by the number that it stuck? Like,
yeah, to them, he's like, for us, like, 153, that means nothing. But for him, it's like 153, I'm telling everybody.
Yeah, but it means, like, it's another evidence that this really happened, because it's like there were so many fish. Like, it's very specific, which is a bizarre detail to throw in there that hints at the veracity of it, apologetically. Mm. And so 153 of these fish, and although there were so many, the net wasn't torn. And Jesus said, come and have breakfast. So he's serving. Hey, I just went to a cross. I just died for you guys, defeated death and sin. And I'm also serving you. Like, let me give you some food. Like, I just, which tell, like, in heaven, he doesn't, his character doesn't change. Mm. He's still the God that's eager to wipe away our tears and to come and to serve, in a sense. That's just the nature of our God, which is just absolutely incredible. And so none of the disciples, even though he looks different, which now this begs some questions, because Isaiah 53 says, you know, he would come into the world. He doesn't have a stately appearance that should draw men to himself. But now in the resurrection, and he did that so that he would have no personal advantage. He doesn't come with wealth. He doesn't come from a, you know, high bred family or anything. And he doesn't have looks. He doesn't take any advantage. But now they're looking at him and it's like, is it really him? Like, does he look different? Is now all of a sudden, is he majestic in appearance? Does he look different? Like, none of them dared ask, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. And so Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. And this was now the third time Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. And so now at this point, he says, okay, Peter, you and I need some alone time. Mm. Now, how are you feeling if Jesus says, you and I, let's go for a walk?
If I'm Peter, I'm not good. I mean, that seems the ancient equivalent of going to the principal's office.
Yeah.
If I messed up like that.
Which means, like, here's the thing. Jesus doesn't just go, oh, sin, no big deal. Mm. Like, yes, big deal. And he's eager to restore you and he's eager to forgive, but he doesn't leave it unaddressed.
Yeah.
Like, okay, Peter, that was kind of rough, you know, but let's go talk about it. It says, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Now, what was Peter's great arrogance? You know, when he says, you know, that everybody's going to walk away from him, Peter says, even if all of them do, I never will. So what is he saying? My discipleship and my loyalty, my love, so much better than all the other apostles. You're lucky to have me, Jesus, because I'm like for sure the best one. And now you have Jesus saying, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? You think you're better than them? You think your discipleship is higher than theirs? What do you think? Do you love me more than these? And Peter says, he cuts off the comparison, but he says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And so I want to pause there because something really important is going on behind the scenes in the Greek.
Okay.
Because the New Testament's written in Greek and they probably were speaking in that sense. And so when Jesus says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? The word for love, the verb for love that he uses is agapao, which is agape love. And there's four different kinds of love in the Greek. Ready? You have storge love, which is like, you know, that's brother, your fellowship, countryman, sports team, loyalty kind of love. You have brotherly love, which is the philos, which
Philadelphia.
Is Philadelphia, where we get that from. You've got eros, which is, you know, where we get the word
erotic,
and that's a sensual love. It's more emotional and physical. But then there's agape, and agape love is decision kind of love. It is a decision of the will. It's a resolute commitment that I might not like you. I might be really mad at you, but I love you enough to where I'm not going to forsake you. I'm not going anywhere. I am committed deep in my bones to the covenant I made with you, and I want your best. Even if I'm mad at you, even if the circumstances are messed up, like, I'm not going anywhere, deeply committed kind of love. That's agapao. And so Jesus is saying, do you agapao me? Right? And he comes back with, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he says, you know that I phileo you, which is philos. Like, it's, you know that I feel a deep affection for you. I want to. Like, I like you a lot. Like, I feel really warm and my affections for you. Like, I want that. And so Jesus says, okay, well, feed my lambs. In other words, you're going to be my shepherd.
Yes.
But he doesn't stop there. He says it a second time. Simon, son of John, do you love me? Do you agapao me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. And it's like, I don't trust myself anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know if I agapao you. I just walked away from you. I just failed you. So all I can give you is, Lord, I feel really strongly for you. Like, I feel deep, deep affection for you. Please, like, know that. And he said to him again, tend my sheep. In other words, you're still my shepherd, bud. But then he said a third time. Now, why is that significant?
It was three denials.
Three denials, and here's going to be three restorations, and I think Peter picks up on that. And he says, "So, but this would feel like Jesus is saying, do you really?
Yeah.
So in the third time, it says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And in this instance, Jesus doesn't come back with an agapao. He says, Simon, son of John, do you phileo me? And he brings it down for Peter. And it says, Peter's grieved because he said to him that third time, do you phileo me? And it's like, Peter realizes, like, okay, he's not walking away from me, but he's coming down to where I'm at. He's dealing with me and all of my insecurities. And he said, you could just imagine the desperate excitement. Lord, you know everything. You know that I phileo you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. You're my guy, bud. You are my disciple. You're my apostle. And it's just like, remember the first time after this miracle, Jesus says, follow me? He does that same exact miracle, and it's like, I haven't changed my mind.
Yes.
I want you to follow me. I'll recall you again. I'll do the same miracle so that I can recall you again and reestablish you. And he says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself, and you walked wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And it says, this he said to show by what kind of death he was going to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. Now, if you're Peter and you're questioning the depth of your love for God, I don't know if I agapao you. I don't know if I would give everything for you. I don't know if I've got that deep resolve in my will that says I'm all in no matter what, yeah. But I phileo you. It sounds like ouch when Jesus says, hey, you're going to die for me, right? You're going to go somewhere you don't want to go, and people are going to stretch out your arms. And we know Peter's crucified upside down in his death. He will be martyred for the Lord. His arms will be outstretched. He'll be taken somewhere he doesn't want to go. But in prophesying that over Peter, you know what he's doing? He's saying, yeah, right now you're at phileo.
Yes.
But I'm telling you, you keep walking with me, and you will get to the point where when you're older, you'll be all in. You will go where you don't want to go, and you'll give your life, everything you have, for my sake. You will reach agapao. And I think that whole, the comparison between those stories is we're always a work in progress, and the Lord's never done with us. And in doing these miracles where he demonstrates his power over nature, he's also, in Peter's case, saying, I want you. Like, I know you think you're sinful and you're unworthy of me, but you're exactly who I want. I'm not going anywhere. And even after Peter's gross failure, it's like, I'll repeat the miracle. I'll repeat the call. Yeah. I'll tell you, follow me all over again. Because as you chase me with those affections, you know what? You're going to grow. And you're going to reach a point where that deep resolve, when you've walked with me long enough, it'll train all your muscle memories and your faith and your instincts and the depths of your heart and your love and devotion. You will become an absolutely sold out disciple. So be patient with yourself. You're going to get there.
Yeah, I like how the restoration is not a light switch for Peter. I like that he has to work through it himself, because that's more of, feels more human to me than like,
yeah,
oh, all of a sudden Peter messed up really bad, and then Jesus comes to him, and then he has this light bulb moment where instantly he's like that. But it's very like, no, he has to work through what he's done, what Jesus is calling him to. And I think that's our stories.
And you find that that's 100%, because it's not light switch. And sometimes you got to learn the same stupid lesson over and over and over and over again before it starts to stick. And you know, even when you get into the early church, like Jesus is going to tell them, I want you to go to the ends of the earth. I want you to take this gospel to the farthest regions, all the nations under heaven. And what do? They sit in Jerusalem and they don't move at all until Stephen is stoned to death and persecution comes to the church. And then they go out. And it's like, you know, I think God is always putting us in circumstances where he is growing our faith graciously, and he's super patient with us. And like you see here in the story of Peter, he's very, very patient with Peter, wanting him to grow in his faith. And it's not like Peter does the shameful thing and he's like, oh, you're off the team, which is the way we operate. And so we fear when we do something that's, you know, terrible in the sight of God, that we're off the team. Mm-hmm. And yet in this story, I love that Jesus is gracious to Peter. And I also love that Peter, in all the grief and all the tears and all the agony and all the questions, also knows that the safest place in the world is right alongside his Savior, who he had come to know intimately, like deeply, for 3 years, to where he knows that his imperfections can be trusted to Jesus, and Jesus will work through them. Mm. He's just awesome. So I love those miracles and how they speak to each other. It's really good.
A lot of people just listen to this in audio form as a podcast because that's what we've been doing. But now the Bible Show is on social medias. You can find us at the Bible Show Podcast on Instagram and on TikTok, if that's your thing, or also on YouTube. So if you ever want to watch this in video format, we'd love you guys would check that out. Like, comment, subscribe, those kinds of things. And our YouTube is also at the Bible Show. And you have to put in the at sign, the Bible Show Podcast, to get to us for right now.
Thanks so much for joining us. We will be jumping in next week with another episode where we're getting into the early miracles that are in Matthew chapter 8, where Jesus is going to be healing a leper, the centurion servant, and Peter's mother-in-law in our next episode. So check that out and see why those miracles are brilliant and beautiful and how they point us to the heart of God. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.